Coming up on Equity, Uber shares its financials, the Amazon Whole Foods deal is finally done, Social Capital finds a workaround for IPOs, and WeWork gets a lot of money from SoftBank. Welcome to Equity. I'm Katie Roof, joined by my colleague Matthew Lindley.
Hello.
Alex is off today, and our special guest today is Rob Conybeare, co-founder and managing director at Shasta Ventures. Thanks for joining us.
Thrilled to be here.
So we're talking about a company that we talk about apparently every week now,
because there's
always something going
on.
Always something going on with Uber, but this time it's good news for them, at least part of it, because they shared their financials with Axios, and then they confirmed it with us.
Which I feel like they've been doing that a lot more often lately, right?
I think it's clearly to say, hey, there's a lot of negative publicity about us, but we're still doing great, or we're still doing good enough. I mean, they're growing. Their gross bookings are up 17% year over year in the 17% since the prior quarter, and then their adjusted net revenue was $1.75 billion, and their adjusted net loss fell 9% quarter over quarter, and global trips more than doubled, 150% year over year. So look, they're growing. Their losses are narrowing. That's good. I mean, it's definitely good. And the reason this quarter is so significant is the second quarter of this year is when all of that drama went down. Ever since Susan Fowler wrote her blog post detailing harassment at Uber, it led to this investigation by Eric Holder, former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, and a whole lot of executive departures. So, I mean, apparently people outside of Silicon Valley don't care as much, or they don't care enough to stop taking Uber. At least that's what the numbers are suggesting.
Well, but, I mean, how much do you think people outside of Silicon Valley are like actually aware of what's going on in Uber? Right?
I don't know. Like 30% of our podcast listeners aren't even in the United States, so some people care.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, if you're I don't know, not in, you know, we'll say we're not in Chicago or New York or wherever. Let's say Montreal in Canada, right? And you're not necessarily plugged into the tech ecosystem, and Lyft isn't available, and cabs are not very great, and Uber actually works, and it's like a pretty decent product there. You know, maybe you're just not actually plugged into what's going on, and you're picking the best product that's available. And it, you know, it turns out that as much of a crap storm as Uber the company is, it still is actually like it is a good product.
Well, they
right?
certainly face competition in most of the geographies that they're in. And the real question that I have is, have they started to release city by city or regional information? Because it's difficult to have a real sense for how the business is doing until you know whether the unit economics have started to work in large regions or not.
I wonder if they're actually afraid of doing that, though, because, I mean, if I'm Lyft, I'm, like, capitalizing on all this. I mean, I'm obviously not coming out and saying I'm woke or whatever, right? But I'm, you know, in the behind the scenes probably, like, signing all these, like, marketing deals and partnerships and trying to get as many people as possible on Lyft. And if you look at, you know, maybe in San Francisco, it doesn't actually look as good as it would in, you know, I don't know, a Houston or an Austin or something along those lines. So I don't know, maybe they're afraid of that, right?
Sure. And actually, they did share that 90% of the growth was in developed markets, 90% growth in developed markets, and over 250% growth in developing markets. So, and this all excludes China, which of course they sold last year. So, but yeah, they didn't break it down city by city, that's for sure, even country by country. So this doesn't give us the full picture. Obviously, they've had problems in China, which they gave up in. They gave up pretty much in Russia. There might be some other regions that they're not doing well in. But overall, the company does continue to grow, which was already built into the expectation when they got that $68 billion valuation. So that doesn't necessarily mean that their valuation isn't going down. In fact, I've heard from a lot of people, including investors, that they are well aware that it's no longer worth the $68.5 billion. Some of them feel like hopefully someday, but there's definitely a lot of skepticism about that valuation right now.
I mean, do you think bringing in a new CEO is going to suddenly fix that, though?
Yeah, and so there's been a lot of talk about who that CEO might be. This week, there's been reporting that it would be Jeff Immelt, who came from GE, but it's not confirmed. Apparently, that's all going to get decided in the next few days, or they're going to try to decide it in the next few days. Obviously, it's a little hard right now, given all the board drama. I mean, we've talked about it on the show before, but Benchmark, which was an early investor in Uber and holds a board seat, is suing Travis, who used to be the CEO of Uber and still has a board seat and has the power to select two more board seats. And they're saying he didn't disclose material information, such as not only the company culture problems, but all the various lawsuits, which I don't even know where to begin with that stuff. But by, you know, by the way, the Waymo lawsuit.
We're at the top of the page of this laundry list of problems, by the way. We can keep going forever.
I would say the one thing that's very interesting when you think about Jeff Immelt as a candidate for CEO of Uber is that he has been in one of the most political public companies of all time. You have multiple business lines. You have lots of managers competing with different ideas for where to deploy the capital. And he knows how to shepherd a company through the public markets. So I think it'll actually, he would be a very strong candidate for that role.
Yeah, that's interesting to hear, because I've gotten mixed feedback from industry insiders. Some of them say, hey, look, he's a seasoned CEO. He's led major company before. So he would be a great person to just, you know, clean things up there. But others are like, well, that's a very different kind of company than Uber, which is a fast growing tech company. So I've definitely gotten mixed feedback about that. But I mean, clearly they need somebody.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because it's a company that's at massive scale when you look at it right now. And company after company has periods where a strategy that worked in the past no longer works in the future. And you look at how long Uber held out against tipping drivers. And that was the type of thing that drove a lot of drivers over to Lyft, was better treatment of the drivers, the ability to earn tips. And things that work well in the early days of growing a market, like not having tips to make it easy for riders, actually becomes an impediment to growth later on. So every company, especially when you get to scale, has to really examine all of their basic assumptions about what makes the business work.
Well, I mean, that's what happened to Facebook, right? They went from that, like, move fast to break things to whatever ridiculous move fast with stable servers or something ridiculous like that, right?
It's a perfect example because you take a look at Facebook, and on one hand, they've stumbled in VR. On the other hand, they acquired Instagram. And in mobile, they made a massive pivot into mobile that people forget about now that really saved the company and set it up for growth. And also, they made a big bet on HTML5 as the way that they were going to build their app.
Yeah, I think he said it was like his biggest strategic mistake ever or something like that.
And acknowledged it and built a native app and built from there. It's really remarkable how many pivots that company's been through. And I think this is a moment where Uber will be going through some of these management and strategy pivots of their own.
I mean, do you think Travis Kalanick is someone that actually would have the same, you know, ability that Mark Zuckerberg had to see, okay, we can't bulldoze our way into this industry at all costs and do what needs to be done, regardless if it's legal or if it's actually, you know, kosher or anything along those lines? Like, does he actually have the capability of doing that?
Well, I think, I mean, he's no longer running the company.
Well, yeah.
There
were
concerns about that. I mean, look, he's obviously a very ambitious person who was instrumental in turning Uber into what it is today. He actually wasn't the first CEO. It was Ryan Graves, but I was reading Brad Stone's book about the early days of Uber. Yeah, it's an interesting book. I mean, clearly Travis has been involved. He was a co-founder. He's been involved since the very beginning. And he built what is a tremendous company. And it's really changed transportation and really changed, made it easier to get everywhere. But he obviously had some blind spots when it came to being a leader that obviously some people within the company love him, but there's a lot of people that left the company because they didn't feel like the culture was the right environment.
Well, it's fascinating when you look at a couple of iconic tech CEOs. You have Steve Jobs with Apple, who left and then came back, and who, as I understand, as Travis has compared himself to, the Steve Jobsing it. At least what I've read in the press.
Right.
The idea of I'm Steve Jobs again. I'm gonna be back. I'm gonna be back. Get ready. But when you look at Uber, you look at the repeat usage, you look at the focus on mobile and the application and the service component of it, it's very different than the products that Apple delivers. And you would ask, do you want to learn from Steve Jobs or do you want to learn from somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, who's gone through a number of these pivots and who has tested a lot of his basic assumptions about the business and where he wants to take it multiple times over the history of the company at very regular annual, biannual intervals?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of like what I was getting at is, you know, is Travis Kalanick, you know, is Mark Zuckerberg really like a genuinely special case, or are there CEOs like Travis Kalanick and all these other people that are, you know, this is the kind of, you know, growth story that every CEO faces as they get to a company of this scale, and it always turns out.
I think that's exactly it. And I think there's no question it's been remarkable. Putting aside the other issues that a lot of people have been talking about, it's remarkable what he's built to get to where he is. But the truly iconic leaders re-examine their basic assumptions every few years to figure out where do they need to go to take the company to the next level.
Yeah, I think to be a great founder, you not only have to be confident enough to believe in your vision and devote all your energy to it, but you also have to be humble enough to be open to feedback and be able to listen to people who say, hey, this is getting out of control here. I mean, I don't know Travis personally, but my understanding is that, you know, it sounds like he just really believed in his own ideas and maybe wasn't always receptive to some other people's.
Well, I mean, it's also kind of rare that you get to a company of this scale and the founder is running it, right? I mean, eventually, you know, or not necessarily rare, but very often you bring in someone who's more of an operational expert that comes in and starts running the company, like Dick Costolo or Eric Schmidt or some of these other people. And yeah, sometimes you get the 180, right, where Jack Dorsey comes back.
Well, and you also have Airbnb, where right. You've had a founder go the distance.
Right, yeah. Like, but it seems like, you know, this, it's not totally out of, I mean, obviously this is maybe a little bit of an extreme case of, you know, the company needing to grow up a little bit and needing some adult supervision. But I mean, it doesn't seem entirely out of the norm, right?
Well, one thing that's interesting about what's going on with Uber right now is there's a common thread with a lot of these stories that are happening now with companies that have gone public or companies like Uber that haven't gone public, which is, where do you find liquidity for the different stakeholders?
Yeah.
So if you look at the investors, obviously Benchmark's been in the news recently. But if you also take a look at the early employees, that's one of the things that people often forget about in the IPO. They talk about the founders and how the founders want to go the distance. They talk about the investors, how they want liquidity. But think about the employees that have gone in. Many of them have actually exercised their options. They've put real money into these options. They actually need to see liquidity. They're the ones that people don't talk about or think about as much. And that's part of the reason that an IPO is so important, or some form of liquidity, so that people that have sacrificed so much can actually pay for their houses, pay for their kids' college education.
And this creates a generation that proliferates out to new startups, right? Like Facebook spawned a whole wave of new startups that, I mean, obviously like a lot of them were acquired, right? But I mean, that kind of liquidity is what starts the next generation, right?
Well, take a look at all the Facebook founders that have come out and started other companies since then and gone on to do very interesting things.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think one thing that's actually particularly hard about Uber is that they made it very hard, almost impossible, for most of their employees to sell shares in secondary transactions. Some companies allow some employees to take some money off the table, but Uber has been very, very strict about that. So these poor employees are really hoping for some sort of liquidity event, which I would think has to be an IPO, although supposedly there are some potential acquirers down the road, but $70 billion is really expensive.
And they've certainly taken a different path, because it's the employee exercise of options that is often overlooked. And that's where you need to come up with real money to buy at a strike price when you leave the company. And there are other leading private companies that have decided to give company or employees years to exercise their options, which arguably is very fair. The whole reason there's option treatment the way there is a tax reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I mean, you have to make an active decision when you exercise these options, like, am I paying capital gains or am I going to pay actual income down the road, right? Like, it's like a very serious financial decision, right, where you can be writing a very, very big check. And honestly, like, you might kind of want to throw up a little bit when you put that money into funny money. But like, I mean, it's like it is kind of like a very difficult decision to make.
Yeah, no, definitely. And my understanding is that some employees had to exercise those options within 90 days of leaving the company. And so if you have a lot of ownership, then that can be really expensive. And especially if you've been paid a startup salary. Just before we move on to the next topic, I wanted to get your sense. What do you think of this benchmark lawsuit? Because we've been asking all the VCs. This is pretty unusual.
Let me guess. People don't want to comment. Is that a fair thing to say? Nobody wants to comment on this.
I mean, look, VCs like to tout themselves as founder friendly. This doesn't come across that way. But some VCs feel like this was a necessary thing to happen. Others feel differently. Where do you stand?
Well, I think the thing that's pretty incontrovertible is that it's unusual. There's no question that it's unusual and arguably unprecedented. But unfortunately, I don't have enough of the facts to be able to give you a strong opinion about whether it has merit or not.
All right. Well, our next topic is the Amazon Whole Foods stuff, which we've also talked about a few times. But hey, like, this is exciting. It's finally happening. The company announced that the deal will close Monday. And guess what? Whole Foods is going to be cheaper now. They said they're going to lower prices on some of the groceries. So I'm really excited because I sometimes feel guilty about going to Whole Foods because it's so much more expensive than like Safeway or whatever. But now
which groceries? Yeah. You said some of the groceries.
Right.
Are they
going
to give the bags away for free?
What a time to be a millennial, man.
And it sounds like there might also be some further discounts for Prime members coming down the line. Of course.
This is why it's hilarious. Is like you see, like it's like, oh, we're buying Whole Foods and we're building this crazy infrastructure. And oh, by the way, Prime members get a discount. You should sign up for Amazon Prime.
You know, it's
synergies.
Pretty like,
oh God, of course everything's a Prime play.
Yeah,
it is pretty amazing that they decided to acquire a premium brand, a premium brand, and a brand that is associated with organic, wholesome, healthy food.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it definitely took me by surprise. It took a lot of people by surprise because Amazon didn't make big acquisitions before this. I mean, I think the biggest one was about $1 billion. So this was $13.7 billion. So regardless of what they were buying, the price tag alone was surprising. And then, of course, Whole Foods, which we don't think of as tech at all, combined with this e-commerce giant. But I mean, the more I think about it, the more it does make sense. They have Amazon Fresh, and this, of course, creates synergies there. And look, if they want to own delivery, then they've got to own food delivery as well. And so Whole Foods seems to be a pretty popular brand.
Well, I'm guessing there's different chains that they must have considered. They must have looked at some of the other chains. Do we acquire Safeway? Do we acquire something else to do this?
Trader Joe's, something along those lines.
Trader Joe's, et cetera. But I think the brand here is a big part of the story, that and the 450 stores that they picked up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I feel like we ask this a lot, but I will once again ask it probably much to the chagrin of our listeners. You know, so you have Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google in front of you, stocks. Which one do you keep?
Oh, that's
wait,
an interesting
what were the
question.
Choices? Facebook, Apple.
Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. And you can keep one. Which one do you keep?
Oh, you have to keep Facebook.
What? Oh, man. Everyone says Amazon. We have someone that doesn't say Amazon.
I would probably go with Amazon, but
look. Yeah, but you know what's going to happen with Amazon. Amazon is going, they're going to be first in line for antitrust.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, and that's what people overlook in Amazon, and that's what's going to be very interesting. If you take a look at Apple and you take a look at a lot of the other big players, they've been a lot smarter about how they've stayed under the antitrust radar.
Mm-hmm. Well, except it's for one Google, of the, right? So.
There's that, but at the end of the day, another brand could come in pretty quickly, mm-hmm. product-wise, yeah. So you can always type something in to the search bar.
Well, I mean, that's
still there.
That's also interesting because it seems that when you kind of think about it, well, so two things. One, we tend to think about Amazon in a very U.S.-centric way, right? And Google, where is Google getting hit? Well, they're getting hit in Europe, right? They're not really getting hit in the United States. And also, it is interesting in that, so I know Katie is going to be very angry at me for mentioning Blue Apron because we've talked about Blue Apron so many times.
It's okay. But, I kind of just feel bad for them at this point.
But, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if this is the right way of explaining it, but Google, it seems, has more or less allowed Bing to exist, right? I mean, I bet if they really, really wanted to, they could just go in and like murder it, right? If they absolutely wanted to and they had the ability to execute on it, decide that we want to be the one and only true search engine, they maybe have the capital and the ability to do that. But, you know, as long as Bing is there,
I think that's exactly
right.
I think it's exactly right. And if you take a look at Apple, I don't know if Apple would admit this, but I think that Android is one of the best things that could have happened to Apple, because they went ahead and they powered with an operating system, a very good operating system, and one that functionally feels very equivalent to iOS, even if it has different prompts and different ways you do it. It's easy to learn it. It allowed them to get, I don't know, 70, 80% market share with Android, but only 10 or 20% of the profitability. So you talk about a way to keep antitrust at bay when you can look at your market share and you can say, hey, I only have, say, 20% of the handsets out there, whatever the exact number is. It's hard to make an antitrust argument, but you can still own 80, maybe 90% of the profitability of the industry.
And it's like going back to Blue Apron. It's like they just decided to potentially bulldoze into Blue Apron's territory when maybe it would have been a better decision to kind of let it do its thing and maybe create a competitor, but not one that is designed to absolutely like smash them out of existence, right? I mean,
yeah, you won't see it for a few years, I think, with our current administration, but when antitrust gears up, they seem to like to go after companies in Seattle.
Actually, I was just at an M&A conference today, and there were very mixed thoughts on what this current administration means for antitrust and M&A. But as for Blue Apron, there was some news this week. They were hit with multiple class action lawsuits. Basically, these are stock drop suits that other companies have experienced, but they're saying they didn't disclose material information, and so related to some of their challenges with customer retention and what have you. So I couldn't even count how many lawsuits there were. When I was writing about this story, I did a quick search, and at first I thought they were the same lawsuit, and then I quickly realized it was a lot of different law firms. They're all trying to get in on this action here. Some of them have plaintiffs, some don't, but it didn't look very good for Blue Apron. But who knows? Facebook had a lot of problems its first few months as a public company, and they turned it around. And so maybe that will happen, but it doesn't look good at all for them right now. It looks pretty sad, actually. But because of all this, social capital, maybe not specifically because of Blue Apron, but because of IPOs that are having problems in general, Social Capital, one of the venture firms out here in the Valley, is doing something called a SPAC, a special purpose acquisition company, which if you look at stuff outside of the tech world, you've probably seen some of these before. They're basically holding companies that exist solely to acquire private companies and make it easier for them to go public so that they don't have to deal with the IPO process. They don't have to deal with bankers. I mean, I guess there's probably technically an M&A banker to do this deal, but it definitely throws the process upside down. So, what do you think of that?
Well, I think it's fascinating, but it is not anything brand new. Mm-hmm. Don't kid yourself. There have been reverse mergers have been around for years, shell companies, different ways of doing this. And when you take a look at going public, I don't think it's the process of going public that people think about. I think they think about more about Blue Apron and what happens with people that had the benefit of hindsight being 2020. After the fact of whether companies want to be public or not. I think that's a much bigger consideration than do I need to work with bankers and do I need to line up these initial blocks of people that are going to invest in the company.
I don't know. Is this like the most Chamath move ever, though?
I don't know. I mean, you know, as you were saying, like SPACs aren't new. They're a little new to venture capital, though. Like I don't remember other venture firms doing something like that.
Yeah, and Chamath is remarkably articulate. If he was in here with us right now, he would have us all convinced that it was something brand new that hadn't existed before. And we'd get into an argument, and he would tie me in knots with the five reasons why this is brand new and exciting as never happened before. But the reality is there have been plenty of ways that people can access and go into the public markets. And part of the reason that you go through the process that you go through when you go through a public offering is because you are talking to investors, whether it's Fidelity and others, that you want to be long-term investors in the company. And a lot of those people, when they buy their initial allocation in the IPO, they buy after the stock starts trading. So there are a lot of reasons that people go through the IPO process, and it's a lot of reasons why it's kind of fun to talk about how it's going to go away, but there's a reason that it's set up and it's happened the way that it has for decades.
Sure. There are, I mean, a lot of complaints about the IPO process, though. Spotify is also doing a direct listing, although it's very different than what Social Capital is doing here. Some complaints relate to just the IPO process where they recruit their buddies, institutional investors and what have you. And it's kind of this exclusive group of people who get in on the IPO price. And although in theory, these people are supposedly the people that are going to hold the stock long term.
The same people that bought Blue Apron on the IPO and are pleased about that now.
Yeah, exactly. And my understanding is there's like trading favors that the bankers say, hey, you might not want to buy Blue Apron, but we'll give you access to the next IPO if you do. I mean, that's sort of understood more or less. And so it's not exactly a democratic process here. When you see all those gains on the first day of an IPO, those are not your typical retail investors. Those are the people who got exclusive access via the bankers. And so there are other groups trying to change that up. Loyal 3 at one point had this idea that fans would they would underwrite IPOs, and that like fans of a consumer facing company would be able to get a small fraction of the shares. There's just been a lot of complaints. That said, there have been a lot of very, very successful IPOs as well. And if it were me and I were running a company, I wouldn't want to experiment a new process with my company. I would probably want to.
The whole thing's a pretty fascinating thing, though. It's at the end of the day, IPO stands for initial public offering. Mm-hmm. And everything that cuts back on IPOs means that for ordinary investors, people that would like to invest in these companies, they can't. And you take a look at Microsoft when it went public at a very low market capitalization, and even Facebook, in retrospect, went public relatively early compared to other companies that are getting the tens of billions of dollars before they go public. And it's part of what you're seeing with SoftBank, with the Vision Fund, et cetera. You see these big eye-popping numbers that are coming along where they're investing billions. But you take a look at the $2.5 billion they put into Flipkart that was announced recently, roughly $1 billion of that is going to liquidity for earlier investors. So these are all people that are happy to avoid the IPO process.
Well, it's also interesting because a lot of these giant companies, they have like capital that they need to put somewhere, right? So like, what do you do with it, right? Okay, well, we might as well throw it at a bunch of startups and see what happens. And then if I'm an investor in a startup, I'm like, yeah, like please let me exit this so I can like de-risk and do a million other things.
And
right?
Move on to the next thing I'd like to do, the next thing I'd like to build.
Yeah, I mean, actually, speaking of WeWork, or sorry, speaking of SoftBank.
SoftBank, the Vision Fund.
There is WeWork, which we've talked about before, but that was a different investment that we talked about because they've been raising a lot of money. And so they're
WeWork, the world's largest retail startup,
real estate
startup,
for,
yeah.
Right. Basically, a lot of startups use their co-working spaces.
Oh, yeah. Co-working and office space. Can you believe that a company like that can raise $4.4 billion?
Yeah.
No, I bet I can, I can believe it.
That was just today. I mean, they've raised even more than that. It's pretty crazy.
But you take a look at that $4.4 billion. Again, that's both primary and secondary. So the secondary means there's definitely earlier investors that are
taking
cashing
out
as
table.
Part of this.
Yeah. I mean, I do believe that a company that owns a bunch of buildings that leases them out at extraordinarily high rents could raise $4.4 billion. I don't know if I'd call it a co-working space.
Right.
But I mean, also at the same time, like WeWork, there's been that like perpetual whisper that they're going to do they tried to do like WeLive or whatever it was, like the hostel dorm.
It's like the circle, right?
Do not live in a co-working space. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Actually, some people in my apartment building in San Francisco have tried to turn their apartments into co-working spaces. Like our next door neighbors. Well, our next door neighbors had like a 3-bedroom in a nice building, and it was also the headquarters of their startup. And so
I mean, I can't count the number of times I've gone to someone's house that like, they rent and you see like 15 standing desks in the living room. It's like, I don't know, is this actually okay? Like, are you actually allowed
There's
to do
definitely
this?
Some zoning challenges.
But yeah, and so $3 billion is going into WeWork directly, and or as you said, some of it is secondary share. So sometimes it's employees or investors of WeWork. We don't know exactly where that's going. And then some of it is going into the subsidiaries like WeWork China, WeWork Japan, WeWork Pacific. Whatever it is, there's a lot happening at WeWork and there's a lot happening at SoftBank because they've been investing everywhere. I mean, they've got almost $100 billion.
Where does SoftBank go next? Let's go around the table really fast. Where does SoftBank go next?
Well, maybe Uber. That's been reported that they are trying to broker a deal.
Have they gone into Airbnb?
Ooh, good question.
Have they gone into Pinterest?
Yeah. Ooh, also a good question.
Any of these big ones. Put a push pin in that.
I feel like they probably would have yelled at the top of their lungs that they went into Pinterest, though, or went into Airbnb or some of these other companies unless
haven't yet, yeah. But they will.
Well, I will say one of the interesting things, you look at the SoftBank numbers, take a look at the $114 million that went into Brain Corp and the $200 million that went into Plenty. They were at pre-monies of roughly the same sort of number. So if you divide them by 100, they almost look like a Series A valuation.
Oh, God.
I wish we could talk about SoftBank all day, but thanks for tuning in. Come back next week.
All right, everyone. We want to say a special thanks to our producer, TechCrunch's own Christopher Gates, our executive producer, Henry Picavet. Thank you to Katie Roof. Thank you to Matthew Lindley. And thank you to you for leaving us that 5-star iTunes review. That's Equity. We'll see you all next Friday.